from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, we'll eat our way through Boyle Heights and find some amazing stewed goat and the best tortillas in Los Angeles. Salad. Ooh, it's much more interesting than you might think. Is irradiation the key to stopping foodborne pathogens? Plus foie gras jelly donuts land in L.A. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. As winter starts turning into spring, and who can tell with this crazy weather that's going on what season we're in, we like to look to the farmers for new and inspiring things to grow and to look for, and of course to our cooks and friends to figure out how to cook them. And Amelia Saltzman is here, as she is every week. And Amelia, you said you were just inspired by some amazing ingredients that you just kind of whipped together last night. Tell us about that.
I had a nice head of radicchio and was immediately inspired. So here is a great cool weather supper that will kind of surprise you, because I think a lot of people don't think about cooking radicchio. They think about it raw only.
Let's describe what a radicchio is and what it looks like.
Perfect. Well, the typical radicchio that you see is a round head, kind of looks like a small, soft red cabbage. And it's really a member of the chicory family. So it's got that bitter edge, which a lot of people like. And at this time of year, after a nice cold winter, it has a sweet undertone. And what I love about radicchio when you cook it is that flavor balance flips. So the sweetness comes forward when you saute it, and the bitterness recedes and just gives it a really interesting complexity. So very simply, take an onion, get it sauteing, cut the radicchio into small wedges, and then add that to the pan and start sauteing. And it'll cook down, it'll lose its color, it'll get kind of a nice, soft, purpley color. And really, this dish will be ready in the time that it takes to boil water and cook a pound of pasta. And that's what I like. So you've sauteed the radicchio and the onion. If you've got a little wine open or a little white wine, add a splash at that point. And then add a third or a half a cup of cream. When it starts to thicken, then stir in some cheese. I think some nice melting cheese, a fontina, a white cheddar, a sheep's milk cheese, something that is sort of warm and robust. An Emmentaler would be great. Any sort of nice European-style cheese, I would say. And toss in the pasta, the cooked pasta, and that's it. That's basically the dish. And when I serve it, what I love with radicchio is I love to finish any radicchio dish with a little drizzle of walnut oil.
Okay, well, certainly the greens now love the cold weather, and they're coming in all robust and just full, and a great way to enjoy everything at the market and then make a hearty meal as well. And newsflash, you can now saute chicory. This is great to know. Thanks so much, Amelia, as always.
Thank you so much.
That was Amelia Saltzman. She is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. And when she's at the market, she is inspired to cook creatively. And that's why we love to catch up and hear what she's got going on in the kitchen. Steve Smith is an organic grower from Santa Paula, and he has an amazing collection of citrus fruit and other things. And Steve, this is pomelo season, and we're talking to you because you not only know a lot about pomelo, you grow a lot of pomelo. So can you explain to us what it is, how many varieties you grow, and explain a little bit about its unique characteristics?
I'll attempt to give you the history of pomelos in the world and the United States. They're actually native to the Far East. There's classified as a Chinese pomelo family, a Thai pomelo family, and an Indonesian pomelo family. And they've been in existence there for thousands of years. Even BC has been documented in China. They came to North America about early 1900s. There were several attempts to get them in, and they played with them in the arboretum in Washington, D.C., and a little bit in Florida, and kind of gradually took off from there. They haven't totally caught on, but they're a magnificent piece of fruit, and we like eating them, we like growing them.
Describe what they look like, and they're a member of the citrus family. Did we mention that?
No, we didn't. We didn't say they're a citrus family. They're actually, the original grapefruit came from pomelo. As it came via Europe into the West Indies, I should say Mediterranean, not Europe. And there's a whole bunch of different varieties in the world. Here in California, there's probably 20, maybe 25 varieties available. And right now, I'm growing about 8 different varieties.
And it seems like you just don't see them in the grocery store, or if you saw one, you wouldn't know it from a grapefruit anyway. So why do you give them so much attention on your farm?
Well, I think they're a magnificent piece of fruit. Some of the pomelos are our kids' favorite fruit to eat, and I enjoy them. And people that try them, you get them hooked.
And so what kind do you grow, and are they like a grapefruit, like there's pink, and then there's white, and then there's yellow, as far as the flesh goes, and there's a difference in sweetness and flavor?
Yes, 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 yes. There's pink ones, there's a nice, deep, rich red one called the Valentine, which I've got the trees, they're not producing yet. There's two California varieties. One is called the Chandler, and that's a pink flesh, and the other's called the Ranking, which is one of our favorite ones. And that the Chandler has a nice, sweet grapefruit flavor along with the pink flesh. And the Rhine King has the nice, sweet grapefruit flavor with a hint of mild lime. And sometimes you can pick up some pineapple essence in it.
Tell me how you eat them, because when people cut them open, they might be surprised at how thick the rind is.
Yeah, they do have very thick rind, and the rind is insipid and somewhat bitter. So you carve them with a big knife. Just cut the fruit sections out and cut the white part or the albedo part of the fruit away, and they're just great. They're delicious.
Okay, great, Steve. Well, your table is just always so fascinating. We love seeing you, and you when you make your appearance, you're so knowledgeable. So thanks for all the info, and thanks for all the great fruit you grow.
That's my pleasure. Yeah, great.
That was Steve Smith, and he's the co-owner with his wife, Robin, of Mud Creek Ranch up in Santa Paula. And they stopped by their table. They not only grow 8 kinds of pomelos, there are up to 200 varieties of other kinds of citrus on the farm. So it's always a pleasure to stop by Mud Creek and see what's happening. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Amelia's creamy radicchio pasta is on the Good Food blog. Speaking of recipes, did you know that you can sign up to receive a weekly recipe from Good Food? You can. Every Friday, you'll receive an email with a seasonal dish. Recipes range from a shaved Brussels sprout salad to blueberry muffins. You can sign up on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. As most of you know, Los Angeles is a huge city. But even those of us who drive across town to work and back aren't aware of all the little nooks and crannies within the city limits. I know that for me, more often than not, what gets me to explore a new neighborhood is the promise of really delicious food. And Boyle Heights, situated across the river from downtown LA, has just that. The neighborhood's been home to a number of immigrant communities over the years, including Russian Jews, African Americans, and Japanese. But today, it is a whopping 94% Latino, and not surprisingly, the neighborhood boasts top-notch restaurants and taquerias. Noah Allison, author of the blog Good Food Preservation, recently took Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson on a walking food tour of the neighborhood. He started it off with a little history lesson.
My name is Noah Allison. I'm an architectural historian for the California Department of Transportation. And right now we're at the Little Tokyo train stop, and we're going to be heading over to Boyle Heights. Boyle Heights was originally in the Spanish and Mexican era called Pardon Blanco, which means white bluffs. There is a gentleman named Andrew A. Boyle, who is an Irish immigrant, came to the United States in the 1800s, made his way to San Francisco, opened a shoe store, eventually made his way down to Los Angeles, opened another shoe store. With that money, was able to purchase Pardon Blanco and started growing vineyards. He had a daughter who married this man named Henry A. Workman, who later became the mayor of Los Angeles. And when Andrew Boyle died, Workman named Pardon Blanco after his father-in-law, and it was now named Boyle Heights. And today, the neighborhood is 94% Latino. The average income in the neighborhood is well below the rest of Los Angeles at $33,000 a year. And because of its proximity to downtown, because of the subway that we're on, because of the historic architecture and low housing prices, it's a neighborhood that's vulnerable to gentrification. So it's a very interesting history, and it's one of my favorite neighborhoods in Los Angeles.
We walk out of the train station at Mariachi Plaza in Boyle Heights, where on any given afternoon, you will find at least a dozen mariachis looking for work. Dressed in traditional mariachi clothing, with instruments in hand, the mariachis congregate, hoping to get picked up to play at a party. We continue walking east on First Street until we get to La Placita del DF, a small storefront known for their semitas.
A semita is like a torta. It's like a sandwich, but it's a little different because it has an egg, a sesame toasted bun with what we're going to get, the milanesa, which is a breaded thin steak, has a lot of avocado, Oaxacan cheese, chipotle salsa, onion. It's delicious.
The semitas are piled high with avocado in a really smoky salsa. But with so much other food to try, we can't finish the whole sandwich. So after a few bites, we're back on the sidewalk, on to our next destination.
We're about to approach Allenby's, a famous burrito place in Los Angeles that's been running for about 50 years, and they have undoubtedly Los Angeles' best bean and cheese burrito. They do have others, but I recommend nothing other than getting the bean and cheese.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. One bean and cheese burrito, verde, please.
Okay, for here to go?
For here.
Alrighty.
So you're going to recognize this taste. Like, you probably had a burrito this good or similar to this burrito before, and it's just going to spark that memory. And you're not going to know where you had that burrito, but it's going to be amazing.
From Allenby's, Noah took me north on St. Louis Street towards Cesar Chavez Boulevard.
We're nearing Cesar Chavez Avenue, and on the east corner of the street is a new establishment called Guisados, and they have amazing tacos. As soon as you walk in, you're going to smell the fresh perfume of fresh tortillas. And they do have tamales and other stuff, but just get the tacos.
If you've never been to Guisados, or even if you have, the best way to experience it is via the mini taco sampler, a selection of 6 different tacos, each nestled in what is arguably the best tortilla you've ever had.
This is our tinga de pollo, mole poblano, chicharrón, steak picado, bistec en salsa roja, and cochinita pibil.
What's the chicharrón marinated in?
In salsa verde. Yes.
Thank you. Let's dig in.
The reason Guisados tortillas are so amazing is because they're made from fresh masa, which is milled next door by the brother of Guisados' owner. After we finished eating, we headed next door to find out just how that fresh corn turns into masa.
So the process for corn cooking is, the corn is actually steeped, which we steep this corn will be used tomorrow. So we put in 600 raw pounds of corn and we steep it for about 48 minutes, turn it off because it continues to cook. Not really cooking, more like I say steeping, and the function is so it can peel. So what you want to do is peel the corn when you wash it to get the actual skin off of the corn. And if you look at the corn, it's actually still raw. It's not cooked, it's just peeled. So you don't want it to cook. So steep it, cool it naturally. Can't be cooled in a refrigerator. It has to be naturally cooled overnight. We wash it as we use it to get the lime out of it. And then we pour it here into our corn grinder. Add a little bit of water. And it goes through the stones down to the bottom. Depending on if we want it for masa or for tortillas. For my brother Armando, he's naturally for tortillas. So he grinded it fine. Armando takes masa approximately every 15, 20 minutes. So
really?
He'll take 10, 12 pounds, 15 pounds. When he's busy, take 20 pounds. But it's always never there more than 20 minutes, 25 minutes at the most. So I just run it back and forth, or he sends somebody over. But it's constantly coming out, and it's still warm.
You guys work out the financing later, I imagine.
I've got a little keep a little tab going for my brother. Now I have to, you know. And then for tamales, it's ground coarser, where it's more porous. So it can be fluffy. And then we mix it here. We beat it with lard, shortening, baking powder, and salt. And that's for your masa. So you buy that, you put it on your tamale husk, and you fill it with whatever you want, and you've got your homemade tamales.
We roll back on to Cesar Chavez Avenue, which is definitely the center of activity in Boyle Heights. We continue walking east past the many bodegas selling fruits and vegetables until we hit Breed Street.
We're on our way to La Favorita Bakery, which is a bakery that's been open for 40 years. And they have some of the best Mexican pastries I've ever had. And there's guys making pastries at all hours of the day. So you grab a tray with some tongs and take whatever you want. And these are the most popular things. Usually the mini conchas, which is the shape of a shell. And they're really fantastic, especially with coffee. And this is a pretty traditional thing to eat in Mexico for dinner, actually. You usually have a larger lunch and then some of these pastries with some coffee. So usually when you walk in here, there are carts dividing the corridor with fresh pastries that come out. But usually if you come early in the morning or late at night, they're here, and they have the best options.
With one more stop to go on our walking food tour of Boyle Heights, our stomachs are nearing capacity. So we order a handful of their popular conchas and cerdas to go and make our way west on 4th Street until we hit 1st Street. We're almost back to where we started. Our last stop of the day is one of the most popular restaurants in Boyle Heights, Birria Jalisco.
So we're here at Birria Jalisco. This is Jalisco is a place in Mexico where they're pretty famous for serving goat. And that's what we're going to be having this afternoon. We're going to be having the Ordon Sortida, which is the full order of like a mixture of goat that has onions, cilantro. It's very delicious. Traditionally, it's eaten with corn tortilla, a little bit of salsa, and cilantro and onion. And that's it. It's very simple. And traditionally, in Mexico, goat is eaten on either Christmas, Mother's Day, weddings, traditional big holidays. But here in Boyle Heights, you could get it any day of the week, whenever you want. And it's open for many hours of the day. So I like to come here and splurge on goat.
After we finish our goat tacos, we somehow manage to stand up and roll ourselves back to the subway station at Mariachi Plaza. The train comes, and before we know it, we're right next to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Little Tokyo. And there's not a single mariachi in sight. That magical world of Boyle Heights suddenly seems like a world away. But fortunately, for those of us in LA, it's not. You just have to go looking for it.
Noah Allison is an architectural historian for the California Department of Transportation and the author of GoodFoodPreservation.com. A link to his article and a food tour map of Boyle Heights, as well as photos of the excursion, are all on our website. What are your favorite food destinations in Los Angeles, and how far are you willing to drive to get there? Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and please click like. Don't go away. We've got more good food coming up after this short break.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleiman on Facebook and click like.
Welcome back to Good Food. World Water Day is March 22nd, and in celebration, we're discussing water issues every week on Good Food for the month of March. Last week, Don Ortega answered a simple question with a complicated answer. Where do Southern Californians get their water? He explained.
We get about 60% of the water in this region from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Bay Delta, which is in Northern California. The Delta area itself is not the origin. The water comes from as far as Lake Oroville and Lake Shasta. It flows through the Delta. The Delta is an estuary, as you know, and we have man-made levees that basically help keep ocean water out and the fresh water conveying through to our pumps that make that water come south.
Importing 60% of our water is a pretty astonishing figure, and perhaps even more shocking is the amount of electricity and energy that it takes to pump all that water right to our taps. Andy Lipkis is the founder and president of Tree People, an environmental nonprofit group based right here in Los Angeles. His vision is to reduce the amount of imported water in Southern California. So I asked Andy to join us today to discuss some alternatives to our current water situation. Andy, most people who live here in Los Angeles and those who don't just assume that the Los Angeles basin is a desert. Is that correct?
It's actually not. We are a semi-arid region. We standardly get 10 to 15 inches of rainfall a year. And deserts get much less than that. So we actually receive a lot of water. And the challenge is that assumption then makes people think we don't have water, and it sets up the extraordinarily dangerous position that we're in today of importing 89% of our water in Los Angeles.
You know, I haven't been born here many years ago. And being, you know, a SoCal native, I'm aware of how much agriculture changed even within my own lifetime. And I understand that we were one of the most productive counties in the U.S. Just a little more than half a century ago. So what happened?
We built houses and we built industry on top of farmland. Farmland wasn't taxed in the right way to preserve it. We're finally starting to do that, but people couldn't afford to hold their land or when they were offered more money for houses or for development. And yeah, I remember the great cornfields, which is now all that area that's been developed next to Playa Vista. And we ate so well going to the various food stands that were all over.
All over. There were road stands everywhere.
Yeah. We didn't just lose our local food supply, which one could say was part of our food security. We sealed the land. So two-thirds of what was nice, porous soil, which captured the rain, put it into our aquifer. It's all been sealed.
What do you mean by sealed?
Well, put on a building, put on asphalt, put on concrete, and all those areas, the water can't get to the ground. Plus, the building code requires that any water that falls on concrete or on your roof actually go to the street. And the street connects to the storm drain, which connects to the ocean.
I'm just curious, haven't we become technologically sophisticated enough to create paving substances that are more permeable?
Absolutely. We are technologically advanced enough to do all kinds of things. We're operating on very, very old engineering principles. The Army Corps' mission was to keep water and people apart for safety and to keep our homes from rotting. But that's so no longer relevant. We throw away almost all the rain that falls here, which translates to 7.6 billion gallons per inch of rainfall.
Translate that into money, since that's how some people think.
So Los Angeles spends, the city of L.A. spends roughly $1 billion a year to import and distribute its water. We pay countywide roughly $500 million a year for the flood control system. Here's the thing. We receive so much water that if we were to capture it and use it right, we believe that the combination of capturing the rainfall and reducing the water we use, we can replace at least half the water we have to import.
Let's go back. I want to go back for a minute to what you said about how we're still using these arcane sort of engineering ideas to keep people and homes away from water.
Yeah.
Is that why there's the L.A. pseudo river?
Yeah. Yeah. In the 1930s, we got a major storm that was worsened by the fact that we had been building and paving L.A. It was a large rainfall anyhow, but much more water hit the river, and rivers meander. They wiggle. So it used to come out at Biona Creek. It wiggled south to Long Beach, and it took out a lot of people. I mean, people died. There was just, you know, millions and millions of dollars in damage. And because it was so dangerous, it was punished and locked into concrete. Unfortunately, that created this greater footprint in L.A. that where we were able to let people build right up to the edge of the river, another very dangerous thing in a floodplain. And now that we're in this period of severe weather from climate change, it means hotter hots, drier dries, and wetter wets, more floods. We have to prepare and protect the people here. You can do that by making the walls of the river bigger and throwing away more water, or by making a really smart, really intelligent system that prepares us and adapts us to the climate change that's hitting us. So we capture the rain in large volumes when it does fall, and that can get us through a year or more when it doesn't. Tree people put in a large cistern at our headquarters, 216,000 gallons, collect the water from a parking lot and from a roof. Well, when that fills, which it did during the drought, we got enough rainfall on the second driest year on record in Los Angeles. We collected enough rainfall in a simple cistern to supply our entire park environmental education headquarters at Coatera Mulholland for a year off the grid.
So one of the things that intrigues me, because I'm so food-centric, is the push and pull and the competing interest between agriculture and urban use.
Yes.
And farmers these days are struggling, and water is costing more, and there's allocations, and there's all kinds of economic trade-offs for them, whether or not they're going to allow land to lay fallow because they can't afford to irrigate. If we end up making smarter decisions in the urban environment, that would then help the agriculture that still flourishes in the state.
Absolutely. It is all one equation. And it is all one whole, and we don't manage it that way at all. So, again, I really have to acknowledge City of Santa Monica for being way out ahead. It now, by fixing the contaminated water that it pumps out of Los Angeles, about 6 months ago, it turned on this great treatment plant from that was built with money that it got from fines from the oil industry, from spills along Bundy. It's gone up to 73% local supply, and Councilman Terry O'Day had the vision that Santa Monica could be 100% locally supplied with water by 2020, and the city is on the path to do that. And if we do that and we extend that to Los Angeles, it frees up so much more water locally for agricultural production at home and in neighborhoods, but also returns the water for use throughout the Central Valley and back up to the Bay Delta.
If I wanted to build my own cistern, I do not have a rain barrel because I quickly understood that it would just make me insane.
Yes.
To watch the water overflow. So if I wanted to build a cistern, would I be allowed to do it?
Now you are. The County Health Department, working with Tree People, Heal the Bay, and I'm sure the Watershed Council actually has passed a set of standards now that declare it safe.
How much would it cost?
Well, the challenge with cisterns at the moment is they are expensive. In fact, I think they're too expensive for individuals to pay for unless they're pretty wealthy. And there are wealthy people doing that, and it's good because they're early adopters. But because it is part of the water system, if we use bond financing, if the government says, yeah, we need to capture all this water to ensure our future and ensure our water safety and our water security, then they should be providing the incentives. And by the way, there's a fantastic model for it. So Australia just came through a 12-year historic drought. It wiped out a lot, but they got through it by giving people cisterns, tanks. I've heard that 20% of the homes in Queensland now have government-supported cisterns installed. And in Sydney, you can't build a house now without a 50,000-liter tank. They made it through. And it's amazing what happens when you give people their own home water bank account. You see what you've got. You radically change your behavior because the water's not coming from some mysterious place. They have the same exact water use per day that we do, about 140 gallons per person per day. They took it down to 30 gallons per person per day, you know, without nuclear-powered desal plants and all of that. And to imagine retrofitting Los Angeles, where everybody can have that little local supply on their home, but we partner with government so they can help pay for it, understanding that we have the shared infrastructure, can imagine a million people changing their homes and creating a much safer LA and much more secure.
Andy Lipkus is the founder and president of Tree People. We've been talking about capturing local water in Southern California. Information about Tree People's water workshops are on our website. Salad, thought of by many as a rabbit food or a cold, watery mess served to suffering dieters, it's not often discussed as the shining star of a meal. But Tamar Adler wants to change that. She's the author of An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace. And she joins us today to explain what exactly salad is.
A salad is any vegetable that has been lightly salted and somehow brightened up, whether it's with a little bit of acid. It's usually with a little bit of acid, then sort of deepened or glossed with something else, usually olive oil. But as I'm saying that, I realize I can think of some wonderful salads that don't have any olive oil. But really, you know, the word salad is related to salt, and it is an issue of salt and some kind of acid.
So, lettuce or no lettuce?
If lettuce is looking beautiful, absolutely. But I think that we too often conflate salad with lettuce. We think, okay, I want a salad, therefore I'm going to go and buy lettuce. And we can overlook some really perfect salad ingredients and sort of head automatically for the bag of lettuce, which is not the realized version of lettuce. Lettuce at its best.
Which is often in the winter, which most people don't realize. And summer, when we all think about eating copious amounts of lettuce salad, often that poor lettuce is just wilting under the hot sun.
I like to tell a story when I talk about salads about when I opened a restaurant with friends in Georgia. And it was an incredibly hot summer in the south in Georgia, and our lettuce was all burnt. There was no lettuce. And so we had to open without a salad on the menu. And I ended up looking around for anything green, and I made a parsley salad. And parsley makes a great salad, and our parsley was heartier than our lettuce, and some other local farms had parsley. And it was really wonderful to see, you know, a dining room full of people happily eating their parsley salads. And we also made little table tents that explained why we don't have lettuce. But when our lettuces did start to grow and we decided not to serve parsley salad anymore, a lot of people asked for the parsley salad, and then we had to explain why we don't have parsley.
Oh, it's so great. So lettuce or no lettuce, do you have rules for what a salad should contain? For example, how many ingredients?
I am a firm believer that a lettuce salad should contain almost always only lettuce. I think that maybe another ingredient. I like thinly sliced cucumbers or thinly sliced radishes. But lettuce is so delicate, and when lettuce is delicious, it's so delicious that it doesn't really want other ingredients. And also it's pretty hard to dress lettuce and a whole series of other ingredients perfectly. So I always advocate dressing one ingredient, maybe two, and dressing them perfectly, and then almost letting that dressed ingredient act as a dressing for the lettuce. You know, one of our big lettuce salad mistakes is that we throw everything into a bowl and then add dressing. And of course, the lettuce, which is incredibly delicate, ends up kind of wilty and overdressed. And the carrots, which needed to sit in the dressing in order to become really delicious, are underdressed. And then we wonder why we don't like salad. So I think that, you know, thinking of lettuce as a lettuce salad and then thinking of tomatoes as a tomato salad and thinking of roasted beets as a roasted beet salad and rice as a rice salad suddenly opens up the world of salad possibility and also makes it so that you're not always reaching for the bad lettuce.
Now, what would be a good example for a salad this time of year, a winter salad?
I really love doing cooked vegetable salads in the winter. One really delicious one is a sweet potato salad, which is a great thing to do in the middle of a week because sweet potatoes are wonderful baked ahead. And I bake a bunch of them all at once whenever I bake one because it's not any harder. And then I like to slice it with its skin on, but you could certainly do it with its skin off. And then put a little bit of red onion or shallot in a bowl with lime juice and add some chili of some sort, like a jalapeno if you have one available to you, or pickled chilies that you've put up during the summer. And then add the sweet potato to that and add a little bit of olive oil and mix that all together and then top it with cilantro or any other herb that you have, you know, growing in the microclimate in which you have somehow jalapenos and cilantro. But a roasted vegetable or a baked vegetable salad like that is great. You can do a similar thing with roasted beets or with roasted broccoli or cauliflower, just changing one or two of those ingredients.
Well, I know what I'm having for dinner tonight. That sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Tamar.
Thank you.
Tamar Adler is the author of An Everlasting Meal, Cooking with Economy and Grace. A recipe for her parsley salad is on the Good Food blog. Up next, could irradiation be the answer to ending foodborne pathogens? Find out in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I have to say that I will never forget the day an Angeli employee asked me how food becomes edible once it comes out of the ground. In particular, he asked if it was irradiated to make it clean after it came out of the dirt. It kind of shocked me that an adult could think that food wasn't edible straight out of the ground, and yet when it comes to irradiating food, we're learning our reluctance to use it may come with a stiff price when it comes to human health. Mark Bittman, purveyor of recipes for good, simple food, and now sensible thinking when it comes to our food system, wrote a thought-provoking piece last year about the use of irradiation and food safety for the New York Times Opinionator. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. What started you thinking about irradiation?
Well, what started me thinking about irradiation was the sort of ongoing crisis that we have. I don't think crisis is too strong a word, in the realm of food safety, where people seem to be dying, not exactly left and right, but frequently enough that these things are actually killing people. And I thought, well, you know, it would be nice to reform the entire food system and have a safe food supply, and I'm certainly in favor of that. But in the meantime, what about this irradiation stuff, which I have probably the same visceral icky reaction to as many of your listeners do, but which I thought was worth a look.
Is it currently being used now on any foodstuffs?
Spices, about a third of our spices are irradiated, and a very, very small amount of meat. This is in the United States. And on other things elsewhere, it's approved for a dozen or so things, including lettuce and spinach. To my knowledge, it's not used on either of those at all.
Now, how does it work?
Well, it works much the same as pasteurization works, by disrupting the molecular structure of microbes and killing them. And it works by exposing them to gamma rays, which is radiation. And the source of those gamma rays can be electricity, it can be a radioactive element. But I think the point is, or one point is, that it no more makes the food radioactive than it does, than an X-ray makes you radioactive.
And what intrigues me is the idea that when we finally learned about the German sprout issue, that it actually came down to the seeds. And if those seeds had been irradiated, then that would have solved the problem.
Well, you know, it's not a panacea. So I think it's probably safer to say that if the seeds had been irradiated, it probably would have solved the problem, or it would have solved the problem unless another problem arose. Because of course, things can become contaminated after they're irradiated. So you can irradiate something, and then they can become contaminated in a different way. And I think it's important to remember that, because that's the way that we can point out, we can continually point out, that really the food system, the food supply, needs to be safe from the farm to the table, and that at every step of the way, there needs to be care taken and probably inspections made, and some of that responsibility is ours in the kitchen. But right now, since we have a disintegrating government, I'm not sure I think that's too harsh a way to put it at the moment, but we don't have the kind of protection that we need to even be sure that we're bringing safe food into the house. And, you know, so people become germophobes, or people become hyper aware of the dangers of the food that they're preparing themselves. And some people actually stop cooking because they think, well, restaurants are going to cook this stuff so that it's not going to kill me. So, and I'm not sure I can. So why not just eat out more? In Denmark, there hasn't been a case of salmonella in years, and they barely even find any salmonella in their food, whereas it's an accepted fact that ground turkey has 10 to 15% of all ground turkey is found to have salmonella in it. So it's, in other words, it's legal to sell food in the United States that is contaminated. The only thing that it's not, the only thing that's not legal to sell in terms of these microbes is E. coli 157, That's been outlawed as a food adulterant. But salmonella has still not been outlawed. You can sell food with salmonella in it.
Would it worry you at all if a greater use of irradiation were discussed, that it would just be used as a Band-Aid to cover up sort of the worst excesses of how our food is created in this country?
Well, that's the argument against it from the progressive point of view, and that is exactly what it would be. It would be a Band-Aid. I think Band-Aids are okay. You want to prevent getting hurt, but no one's doing that right now. So I don't see why trying to make things a little bit better after the fact is a crime while we work towards making things better before the fact. We want a safer food supply.
Now, let's talk about one thing in particular. Whenever we hear about outbreaks, we always hear about the deaths, and the deaths usually are in the under 100 number of people who die. But there are much greater numbers of people who are very seriously sickened and who live with a legacy of their encounter with unsafe food for the rest of their lives.
The E. coli thing is the worst. I mean, I believe the last number was around 50 deaths, which is a lot. You know, we hear of many things that kill more people every day, but it's a lot of people to be killed for eating fenugreek sprouts. But there were over 3,000 people sickened, and all of them were sickened at least as badly as you would be sickened by the flu, which, as we all know, is not pleasant. But of those, I think the final number is somewhere between 600 and 1,000 have HUS, which is kidney failure of varying proportions, but some of which can leave you on dialysis. A lot of these people are going to be left on dialysis for the rest of their life.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Great to be here, as always.
That was Mark Bittman of the New York Times. We've been talking about irradiating food. A link to Mark's 2011 article about irradiation is on our website. If the idea of irradiated meat freaks you out, one solution is to raise your own. Suvir Saran is the chef and owner of Davy in New York City and a tirelessly curious teacher, cookbook author, and now farmer as well. He and his partner, Charlie Bird, recently moved to a 19th century farmhouse in the Hudson Valley, 4 hours north of Manhattan. They have fallen in love with their chickens, goats, and their new rural lifestyle. Suvir joins us today to tell us what he's discovered as a farm owner.
I found chickens, I found alpacas, I found geese, sheep, I found coyotes, ducks and geese, and all of them helped me find my soul. I realized how crazy I am, how little patience I have, even though my mother always said I had the patience of a saint. And I realized how city folks live so differently than farmers, who can give you an amazing reality of life they can bring to you that others can't.
Why do you think you fell in love with birds so deeply?
You know, they care nothing about who you are. And it's playing at their terms with what they want to do. And you realize how banal you are as a human being, one person in this larger, huge world that exists without you, even if you think you control it.
How many do you have right now? What's your bird census?
A little over 200, Evan.
And are they all heritage breeds?
They are, and some are inbred heritage breeds. You know, they've crossbred, and I can't teach them not to be incestuous.
We should say that most people, when they buy these kinds of birds, they arrive via a FedEx truck, right?
Or the USPS, United States Postal Service trucks, yeah. And they're beautiful. These little birds are just hatching out of their eggs. They can stay without any food for up to 2 days, 48 hours. So they're covered in their own albumin and yolk, and they're eating that as they come out. And it's fantastic what you see, the little chirpy birds that look at you and say, forget who you are, become meat, feed me, treat me like my mother would, and allow me to live.
Okay, this last part of the sentence, allow me to live. Do you ever use the birds for meat?
You know, we have one set of duck breasts that are in the freezer of goose breast that is in the freezer from a goose that was the inbred missing link that had to be culled. And other than that, we've never used our own birds for the table, but we do use the boy goats, the kids that are boys that are born to the goats become meat for the table.
And why is that?
We are building a dairy herd, and so the boys are pretty much useless unless we want the family tree to be a family wreath. And so to just keep the genetic lines clean, the boys become meat.
One of the things that really struck me paging through the cookbook is how much of your life out there seems to be elaborate.
Boring?
No, not at all. The opposite. Elaborated upon by people dropping in, visiting, and making food for you.
You know, it is. We do make food for each other, and I think a lot of my friends do come and cook for me. It's our home has become the Grand Central Station of North Country. If people want something to do outside of their own farms or homes, they know they can come to our home without notice and create with me a feast that will be a feast for the senses, all of them, not just the sense of taste. And we do that by working together. If I have things in the refrigerator, vegetables, meats, cheeses, dairy that's looking at me and saying, tomorrow or day after, I may not be all that fresh. We cook with it. We all work in teams. I assign different people different tasks. Some people fold the napkins, put them on the table. Another polishes the silver, puts the silver at the table. You know, we all work together. And I think that sense of community, that sense of working for your meal makes everybody comfortable. And I'm hoping to share with people that the only reason I can do this so unexpectedly is that I don't feel scared to be judged. Because as I give people tasks to do, I'm buying their ownership into this creation of a meal. And nobody judges what they do themselves. And so at the table, we go beyond being judged. We become people that talk about everything but the food. The oohs and ahs of flavor happen, and then we are all about politics, sex, religion, race, gender, everything else but food.
I love that. I love the idea that we shouldn't be judged at the table. That's happening way too much. So share with us a recipe that has become a part of the farm that came from the outside.
You know, there was this, I have this recipe for dumplings, vegetarian dumplings, that our friend Sally Longo brought to the table. And she made pork dumplings that I had, which were beautiful. But I was missing spice and aromatics and just a little something extra that Chinatown brought to me, which were, you know, the veggies that were also mixed into the pork dumpling. And as a mostly vegetarian person, I also miss this pure vegetarian pot sticker. So together she and I created a veggie dumpling. She then talked to me about this terrine she made with rabbit meat. And she kept telling me she would put almonds in it. And it just didn't sing and dance to me as a concept. So I said, what if I make your rabbit terrine with pistachios and fennel fronds and pernod? And she said to me, I would love it. So then that recipe came from Sally. For me, food is as much about what you look at as what you eat. I learned that from our mutual friend, Joyce Goldstein. She would always say you eat both with your eyes and your tongue. And so I could visualize this rabbit terrine being so familiar to people who enjoy terrines and yet being what a graphic designer, art history student should be making. And so that Sally and I created together.
Okay, leave us with a good taste in our mouth. Share another recipe from the book.
You know, we have this tamarind chicken wings that are wonderful. All I do is I take the most beautiful, simple wings you can find, and then I marinate them with garam masala and some olive oil and let them sit for a few minutes. You rub them nicely, make a little, you know, have a love affair with them for a few minutes and massage them and put them away. And then I make a tamarind chutney with some tamarind concentrate, a little powdered ginger, a little cayenne pepper. And the chutney is hot, sour, salty, sweet all at once. And once the chicken has marinated for a few minutes, you bake it, pull it out just a few minutes shy of being perfectly cooked. Toss it in the chutney, back in the oven, and you bring it out 5 minutes later, and you have the stickiest, most savory, most sweet, sour, spicy chicken wings you've ever eaten. And people who eat them are like, oh my God, these are the best chicken wings I've had. They're not all about heat. They're all about flavor.
As always, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much, Suvir.
Thank you for having me. You're too kind.
Suvir Saran's latest book is Masala Farm, Recipes and Tales from an Uncommon Life in the Country. A recipe for his tamarind chicken wings is on the Good Food blog. I've made them, and boy, are they good. Don't go away. I've got Jonathan Gold in the studio with me next. He's got a new restaurant suggestion you won't want to miss. Stay tuned.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. It's that time when Jonathan Gold stops by for a visit. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer now at the LA Times. And we love when he stops by and tells us where to eat this week in LA. Today, we're going to eat some dude food in downtown LA.
We are going to the brand new, spanking new Umami Kitesen.
Is this brought to us by Umami Burger people?
Good guess. Umami Kitesen is sort of a omnibus-style restaurant. The heart of the menu and the place, and I guess the ownership, is, you know, Adam Fleischman, who does Umami Burger. But there's a, I guess, pork concession that's run by Chris Cosentino, who has that restaurant Encanto and the Boccolone cured meats in the Bay Area. And a deli concession that is supervised, I think, by Micah Wexler, who's at Mezza here. And a sort of coffee and donuts concession. I don't know who does that, but it's interesting.
So is it like a little market hall?
I was expecting that when I'd heard about it before I went there. But you go in there and it's like a restaurant. And then there's the different kitchens for the different sorts of foods are sort of scattered around the edges.
So what was the dudest food you had?
There is almost no end to the dutiness of this food. For example, if you're getting fries, they will probably come from the pork concession, which is called Pig, two G's. And the fries are fried in lard. Or if fries are just not dudish enough, you can also get fried pig's ears or the most delicious light chicharrones you've ever had.
Now, the pig's ears, what do you dip them in?
It says on the menu, brainaise. I don't know. I've almost been afraid to ask if they actually are whipping brains into mayonnaise. But
What else could it be?
And Chris Cosentino is, of course, the king of all things awful.
The pig's ears, are they presented whole or are they in slivers?
They're sliced and they're fried and they're crunchy and they have these sort of nifty geometric cone sort of things, paper cones that they fit inside these metal holders that look almost like sconces with a base. And you take them out and you eat them like fries, I guess, dipping them in the brainaise.
Wow, that's pretty intense.
You'd never believe what I had for breakfast this morning.
What did you have for breakfast?
I had what they call a FG&J donut.
A foie gras and jelly donut.
You're good.
That actually could be something so unbelievably delicious.
The donut concession at this place is great. I mean, you know how loyal I am to Bob's, right?
Yes.
You know, I would be happy to be buried in a tomb made out of Bob's donuts conjoined by toothpicks. But these might be the best donuts in L.A., and not just the foie gras part. I mean, they're great donuts.
Okay, so describe the donut-y part.
They fry them to order, which means that whatever donut you get is just out of the fryer and has that, you know, crisp, slightly chewy crust to it. And then it's like almost liquidy inside. And, you know, anybody who's ever like stood outside the door at Winchell's at 5 a.m. knows exactly what I'm talking about. And the PBJ is just, it's filled with a really good jelly. And they call it jelly of the forest, I think.
Yeah, frutti di bosco, in other words.
Yeah.
Is it Robert Lambert jelly?
It is Robert Lambert jelly, which is really good jelly. That's one of the best jellies you can get.
Yeah, it's very expensive jelly.
It's really expensive. And then there's like a little squirt of pureed foie gras mousse. If I were in conspiracy theory mode, I would say that they're adding the foie gras to it because you think foie gras is expensive, but what they're really doing is subsidizing the jelly.
That's so funny. It sounds incredibly delicious to me. Really, really good. Okay, so we've been talking about all this little snacky stuff. What are the meat and potatoes, as it were?
Well, there's umami burgers of every sort. We've talked about umami burgers on the show, and I'm sure almost everybody listening has been to an umami burger. Just imagine the last umami burger you had. That's what you're going to get here. So they have a couple different types, like there's one with pastrami on it.
Wow. I mean, their burgers are so rich anyway with pastrami on it. Wow. That's pretty crazy intense. What's the best time of day to go here? Is this breakfast, lunch, or dinner?
All of them. I mean, it's open, I think, straight from maybe 11 a.m. through to 3 a.m., although the hours aren't set yet. They have a really good bar program set up by Adrian, who's done Harvard and Stone. I think it's probably thought of as more like a late-night place, but it's really nice at breakfast, too, especially if you're, like, okay with the kind of restaurants whose customers include, you know, 45-year-old attorneys who show up at the restaurant on skateboards.
Any other food you wish to share with us that you've had? It's sort of early days. You haven't gone – you've only gone how many times?
I've been three times, but it's only been open for 5 days. So I don't even know why I'm talking about it this early. I want a seat there this Saturday, and I'm not going to have one because it's going to be on the show.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Umami Catessen on Broadway between 8th and 9th in downtown L.A. You know that you can get a text message that gives you the exact address and Jonathan's favorite dishes by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also find Good Food very conveniently on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia's our segment producer. And the executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and to Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.